She's the project evaluator. We had the administrator before. This is the project evaluator for the PBHCI grant, Capital Area Human Services District. And her practice background is in addiction. Another good match, so take it away. And she's also going to be joined, after she's done with, by Jamie Rock. I'll introduce Jamie separately. Talk about that.
Thank you, Margaret. And also thank you, Freddie, for providing a really good overview of our program, which is called the Total Health Program, which is very similar to the PATH program. And I am taking a slightly different route here by looking at some of the data that we've collected. But before I do that, Freddie emphasized the importance of leadership. And so I want to acknowledge a couple of people who were here. First of all, Dr. Jan Kozlowski is the director of Capital Area Human Services District. She's not here now because she's actually meeting with somebody else to try to find a way to mitigate the $200 million budgetary shortfall that's going to fall on the backs of healthcare and higher ed this week and next week. And it's outpatient care, the population that I'll be talking about today, that's going to get slammed. Dr. Kozlowski, and I have no qualms at all saying that she's one of my heroes because she always does the right thing. She's five steps ahead of everybody else. The reason that we were able to get this grant is because it built upon a mobile health unit and Red Cross monies that she used at Katrina. And so we, too, did not get funded the first go-around. Got really high scores, and then got the good news that the project was funded soon after that. I want to acknowledge Vivian Geddes, who is part of Jan's administrative team. Vivian and I co-wrote the grant. And I also want to acknowledge Jamie Rock, who was the project director, who, if she's looking well-rested and especially lovely, it's because she retired recently. No gloating, Jamie. And so Jamie was the one who got us through that launching off, all the fits and starts of the program startup, and getting folks to coordinate. And I also want to acknowledge Sherry Ewing, who is the nursing supervisor. Is that your right title? So she oversees the nurse care managers, who really are the glue of the project. And finally, I would be remiss to not introduce Kayla Allison, who is my grad assistant. She's a doctoral student with the School of Social Work. And so with my background in addictions, I've also suffered some identity crises over the last 10 years because I used to proudly say that I worked in addiction, and then I had to change my mind and proudly say that I worked in co-occurring. And then I had to change my mind, and now I just call myself behavioral health. And as I look back and reflect on my background, I am all of those things. So I, too, have to keep up with the program. And this project has really helped me leap into the present. So Kayla enters all of the data that we collect into a separate SPSS database. So those of you who are familiar with SAMHSA, you know that you've got to collect data through the NOMS form. All of that goes into a federal database. I do that. And then Kayla and I have a system worked out where she takes all of that data, enters into an SPSS database. And so I knew starting this project that we were going to be really, really blessed with an abundance of helpful data that can start telling stories about a very unique population of persons with serious mental illness. So let me say, acknowledged all those people. So this study is a piece of about three or four other larger pieces that I have going on right now. This is a correlational piece that I want to talk about that describes the characteristics of about the first 125 people who came through the Total Health Program when we launched in January of 2012. We launched a little bit earlier than that, but we pretty much opened the doors and started admitting clients. And so the project that I'm going to be talking about today is based on the first 125 folks who walked through the door at this Community Mental Health Center, Capital Area Human Services District, which I'm just going to call Capital Area. Okay? And my goal is, and our goal, is to begin really building knowledge about this unique subpopulation of clients. So we have the opportunity to collect integrated data. and to use that integrated data to make decisions about who is getting services, who is not. What are the additional health disparities that are occurring with this population? So we already know that people with serious mental illness, they access their primary care through a community mental health center, although most mental health services are provided by primary care providers. So a lot of the work that's been done with community mental health centers, most of that is coming from Emory and Dartmouth universities right now, because they have the big grants to be funding the randomized controlled trials that's really checking to see, do these projects actually work with this population? And so this research that's coming out from these universities is showing that we're looking at the concepts that Margaret introduced earlier and Becky talked about in terms of being important to recovery. So when we're talking about health, we have to be talking about psychosocial functioning. We also have to talk about the environment and the context in which clients find themselves. And so working with this integrated data set is a tremendous opportunity to begin telling stories about the individuals who are presenting for services. And so most of the studies that we've seen that have come out so far have looked at major health outcomes of interest, which is one of the slides that Freddie had. So are we increasing access? Are we increasing compliance with folks keeping their PCP appointments? Because we know if you get them in the path of a primary care provider, chances are they will be more compliant. I don't like that word as a social worker or as a person with a background in addictions. But basically, they're going to keep their appointments and they're going to follow the doc's advice, and they're going to get better, and their outcomes will improve, okay? And so a lot of the research has looked at this. Have we reduced ER admissions? Have we increased PCP compliance? That's what they call it. And also different aspects of health and mental health-related functioning. Now, this has been really important. And so in looking at how people are functioning, a lot of the research has used scales and measures that are specifically designed for persons with schizophrenia, persons with bipolar disorder, the SF-36, which looks strictly at health-related functioning, not really looking at functioning for a higher functioning, more stable population that can receive services on an outpatient basis. So we don't really know a whole lot about some of these characteristics, and so that has been my mission, basically, is to begin some of these descriptive pieces by really using this integrated data set to start to tell some stories. And so we need this information to identify health disparities. So we already know that people who are accessing primary care through a community mental health center are very different from the folks who are in the waiting room who don't want to see the nurse care manager. And so we're talking about a vulnerable population, and the data that I'll be showing you is going to describe a vulnerable population in terms of those health outcomes. But sitting in the waiting room next to this vulnerable population are even more vulnerable people who don't necessarily place a premium on their health, who don't necessarily want to put themselves in the path of a provider. And so having this information is going to help us identify individuals who are experiencing these health disparities. So the Total Health Care, the Total Health Program, the THP, that's our logo. We have really cool polos, too, in a nice shade of purple, similar to that. Uses a care management approach. We have, in the literature, there's about 90 randomized controlled trials. The Cochrane Collaborative Database just came out with a meta-analysis showing that this care management approach is really effective in having individuals keep their primary care appointments. It's effective in linking individuals with a medical home that they go to for their health care. Having individuals keep their appointments with their nurse care managers, and also linking them with other types of services, the myriad services that they need in addition to the ones that are provided at the community mental health center. And so the care management approach has been used and has been used very effectively in the primary care setting. So we know that if you take the time and you administer the K6, you administer a screening for depression or anxiety with someone with whose blood pressure is out the roof, with a combination of talk therapy and medication, that blood pressure begins to come down because you're treating both the depression and you're treating the blood pressure simultaneously. So we don't need any more outcome studies to say that that's effective. Well, if you want to do more, that's fine. Okay? What we really need is information coming from the community mental health center settings as well, because the care management approach is that co-location that Freddie and Margaret and Becky were talking about, where the nurse care managers are actually embedded in the setting and they're working very closely with the behavioral health care providers. And so this idea of leadership and coordination becomes really, really important, because you have individuals who have very different ways of looking at clients and patients working together to kind of improve all of these sort of global recovery-oriented outcomes. So the care management approach, screening and tracking. So screening, doing the blood work, doing the mechanical health indicators, and tracking individuals over time, okay? Linking individuals to a medical home, sometimes a federally qualified healthcare center, sometimes not, and that, for many of you probably in your communities, that is a constantly shifting ground as hospitals close, as practices change, as funding, of course, changes in funding mechanisms. So that's pretty much a full-time job right there, trying to keep people hooked up. Thank you, Margaret. And referring, of course, to the wellness programs that Freddie described as well. So, those of you who are not familiar with the NOMS tool, Kayla has brought some copies in purple, which she's going to distribute just so that you can see the types of data that we're collecting. And so we collect data on demographics. Embedded in the NOMS tool are measures for psychosocial functioning. That includes the K6. That includes a measure of daily functioning. We also collect data on housing, education, employment, and social connectedness, which actually measures social support and social networks as well. We developed, and when I say we, the nurse care managers and I and the project director, we developed a physical health indicators form where we collect information about their PCP, whether they have health insurance, their diagnoses, medications, the health indicators, health risk behaviors, smoking, drinking, substance use, family history, and personal history of substance use, and medical history as well. These are the health indicators that Becky talked about. These are the data that we collect at baseline. We collect mechanical health indicators, the non-blood work, every 6 months. On an annual basis, we collect the blood work for the lipid panel and for the fasting blood glucose, or the HGVA1C. The sample is primarily female, white, with an average age of 45 years old. Two-thirds have a high school diploma or less. Over one-third were employed or were looking for work. 17% self-reported that they had diabetes, 17% self-reported cardiac disease, and almost half said that they had high blood pressure. These are the at-risk cutoffs, okay? So this is the Center for Integrated Health Solutions. These are the thresholds that indicate whether somebody is at risk on a particular health indicator. At baseline, these are the mean health indicator scores and the percent at risk on each of these health indicators. And so you can see that the percent at risk ranged from a low of one-third on triglycerides to almost 75%, almost three-fourths were at risk in terms of their BMI score, and half were at risk in terms of their systolic blood pressure. And so, again, these were the scores of individuals who were coming in upon enrollment, and these data were collected by the nurse care managers, recorded in the form, scanned by me, entered by me, entered by Kayla or someone like Kayla. We collect information with one general self-rated health item. How would you rate your health? And they rated their health as at 2.3, which is slightly better than fair. In terms of their family history, over 3/4 had a family history of high blood pressure, 2/3 histories of diabetes and cardiac disease, and a small percentage weren't really sure about their family history. So I was interested in, with this objective health data, how can we use this to link to family history and to link to some of the psychosocial characteristics as well. And so two health indicators distinguished those individuals who had a family history of a particular cardiometabolic condition from those who did not, and that was diastolic blood pressure and total cholesterol. And so if you had a positive family history of cardiac disease, your diastolic blood pressure on average was higher than somebody who didn't have that family history. And the same was true for total cholesterol as well. And both total cholesterol is in the at-risk range for those who have that family history. A similar pattern with high blood pressure and with diabetes, with those who had a family history of that showing higher average blood pressure scores and average total cholesterol with a history of diabetes. 2/3 had a mood disorder, a little different from what we see in the literature, where individuals are primarily older, predominantly white males with thought disorders, most of them homeless and or veterans. And so this is really a distinct subpopulation of mental health clients. Their score on the K-6 was moderate, indicating moderate psychological distress. Fairly well social connectedness scores, again, rather stable population. And their daily functioning was at a 27.4, which ranged to 38, which indicated moderate levels of functioning. So I ran some quick and dirty correlational analyses. Again, this is part of a larger multivariate piece that looks at predictors of self-rated health. And this shows that, just really curious to see, do these objective health data in any way correlate with how people see themselves and their self-rated health. And so here we have overall health correlated, very low, weak correlations with blood pressure and with blood glucose. We see stronger associations with the K6, the measure of psychological distress and social connectedness. So the stronger association was with a psychosocial variable, not the objective health data. The same thing with psychological distress. We see stronger associations with the measure of overall health and with social connectedness, both negative, both moderate. And then the lipodensity and the triglycerides also modest correlations with whether or not they were experiencing psychological distress. And finally, the social connectedness, the perception of social connectedness subscale in the NOMS form did not correlate with any objective health data at all, just the overall health, and then related negatively. Stop. She's just holding up the stop sign. So, all right. Very quickly. I'll be very quick. I know. I'm on borrowed time. Thank you. And so the population that is being served by this total health program and this grant is a relatively stable adult with a mood disorder, very different from what we see in the literature right now. Their self-rated health seems to be fairly congruent with the health data that we collected, and I'm very interested in looking more at this general self-rated health item and how it distinguishes the less healthy from the more healthy in this population. And self-assessed health was more strongly associated with psychosocial than with the objective health data. And so, as I said earlier, there's a pool of community mental health clients that are probably at greater risk because they are not stepping up to be in the path of a provider. I think that there's a call for client education regarding what do these objective health data mean. What does it mean to have this family history? And then I think that if we're working with a more stable population, we need to ask some additional questions about their health literacy, about spirituality, from a resiliency standpoint, and working with predominantly African-American clients, peer support, and then a lot of our clients were taking care of others and their caregiving responsibilities as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we wanted to fit in. So those speakers are running short on Q&A time at this point. But I feel like it's important to go over the findings of the project, which we will do. I wanted to put Jamie Rock was just retired, as you know, but she was the director of behavioral health and primary care integration for this project and wanted to make a comment about accidental care. You have 5 minutes.
Okay. I just wanted to mention real briefly about one of the initiatives that we did in our project, which I think is very beneficial, and you see some of the implications. That's me, no disclosures, some other authors. And so what we did was oral health of clients with SMI is rarely regarded as a health issue. I'm not sure how many of you all think about oral health when you take care of behavioral health clients. Tooth and gum disease was the third most common medical comorbidity in the Peak Care trial, which was a trial of 407 clients with SMI in a community mental health center. Antipsychotics, antidepressants, and mood stabilizers cause dryness of the mouth. Caries, gingivitis, and periodontal disease are prevalent among our clients with SMI. Louisiana ranks among the states with the lowest rates of dental visits, 50%, and I can tell you that our Medicaid program does not cover dental services for the adult population. Persons with SMI are at a greater risk than the general population for receiving inappropriate dental care. Untreated tooth and gum disease is associated with endocarditis, and poor dental status reduces social and work opportunities. So intervention programs are urgently needed to facilitate access to dental care, to address modifiable risk factors, smoking, medication, side effects, and reduce inequities in oral health care. So in 2013, we launched a dental initiative using approved carryover funds from the PBHCI grant year one. A total of 45 clients received 5 to 6 appointments each to complete extensive dental work. Over 200 dental appointments were scheduled for clients, and in this population that usually has a high no-show rate, only 2 appointments were missed for dental services. Each participant was contacted to confirm that dental services were provided, and patient satisfaction information was obtained about the dental provider and services received. And if you're interested in knowing a little bit about how we did that, I'll be glad to share that with you afterwards, the organization of the program. These are some of the comments we received from some of the patients we serve. The dentist made me feel beautiful. I have a new inner me, and I feel like I'm worth something. Before this, I had repetitive nightmares. I'm schizophrenic and fearful. They made me feel very comfortable. It's like a godsend to me. I've had to learn how to smile again. I appreciate everyone that had anything to do with it. It was a very positive experience. The dentist told me he cared about people with extenuating circumstances. The best blessing of my life. I have had the most absolutely gorgeous and straight teeth I've ever had in my entire life. I'm totally happy, and it blew my mind that they would do so much for me. It's made a difference in my life. So the comments here show you how important dental services are, and it really did a lot to relieve dental pain and treating tooth and gum disease. So if you think about that, a lot of these patients have problems with their own inner being, they feel uncomfortable, they have problems with, we ask them to eat healthy foods, fruits and vegetables, and they have rotten teeth. How can they do that? They're in chronic pain. So oral health is so imperative, even more so with this population. So the point is that the program enhanced emotional, mental health, and physical health for our patients. The dental professionals were eager to address the oral health care needs of the vulnerable populations. Some persons with SMI, even those who are symptomatic, are willing to receive dental treatment when it's provided in the context of an integrated health care service delivery system. The positive outcomes emphasize the importance of oral health among persons with SMI, which is overlooked, really underfunded, and largely inaccessible. And the oral health of persons with SMI is a critical issue for healthcare policymakers. So I guess what I want you to leave with is to understand the importance and urge people who have any carryover funding in your PBHCI project to think about spending it in the unmet oral health care needs among your program participants. It's not that difficult to do, and I'll be glad to share information with you all. And the process and outcomes of the dental initiatives should be rigorously evaluated. Thank you.